You're tuned in, tuned up, and ready to go. Welcome to Rhea's Ham Shack, a weekly conversation about amateur radio, shortwave listening, and radio tech, hosted by Rhea Gyrum, N2RJ, and heard weekly on WRMI Legends Shortwave. And now, here's your host, Rhea.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Rhea's Ham Shack right here on WRMI Legends. If you'd like to support the show, you can go to WRMILegends.com and you find ways to support the show. I'd like to thank Ted Randall, Holly, and the rest of the crew at WRMI Legends, and also Jeff White and his crew at WRMI Radio down there in Okeechobee, Florida, who keep the tubes going and keep the transmitters running to broadcast this show and others on the air. Well, this week we are going to talk about how to be a good ham, how to, you know, dedicate yourself to the hobby. And by that, we don't mean giving up your whole life, but how to, you know, be a good example. And we'll talk about some bad examples as well, too, because there have been some bad examples in the news lately. All right. So we're going to talk about how to be good. Well, how are you doing? I hope everything's okay. And I've not been okay, to be quite honest. I've had I came down with a mystery illness last week. And before this gets into 75 meters, you know, a discussion, I just was in bed most of the week. And my wonderful kids actually took care of me. So I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that they were there to do that for me. And, you know, I always treasure every moment with them. But first, let's talk about the news and how you can get the wonderful newsletter that I publish every week. Do you know I have one? Well, I'll explain how to get it right here. Hang tight, we'll be back.
You love the news on Rhea's Ham Shack, you're going to absolutely love the news on Rhea's Substack. So to go to n2rj.substack.com, where you'll find the news, views, and opinions, and all sorts of interesting angles that you will find nowhere else. n2rj.substack.com. It's a weekly newsletter. It's absolutely free. You can sign up. You can tell your friends. You can learn about all the happenings in ham radio for the past week. And, you know, some interesting news, views, opinions, and commentary, which you'll really not find anywhere else. n2rj.substack.com. n2rj.substack.com. We put it in your inbox once a week. And you get a convenient digest to read everything you need to know about amateur radio. N2RJ.substack.com, N2RJ.substack.com. Be sure to subscribe.
So let's get the elephant out of the room. Well, let's talk about the elephant in the room first. Recently there was, and we're going to talk about a little bit in the news, there was an incident of somebody with a ham radio license who was fined $24,000 by the FCC for jamming a net called the WARFANET. And if you don't know what the WARFANET is, it is the Western Amateur Radio Friendship Association. And this net, they say on their website that how they were started off as a network of fishing enthusiasts with RVs, who are ham radio operators. But if you look a little deeper, you'll find out that they're a little more than that. They're essentially a network of, they have all sorts of people from different black backgrounds. They have a lot of minorities in there, you know, black and other minorities as well too. And I believe amateur radio is a community for everybody, first of all. So I support everybody who could get an amateur radio license and who obey the rules getting into amateur radio. Some people, I don't know, some people think that maybe that's a bridge too far or whatever motivation they have. So they end up jamming and behaving badly. And then they get fined thousands of dollars by the FCC. Does it really have to get that way? Do we really have to get to the point where, well, you know, we're behaving so badly and setting such a bad example for the community? You know, I was reminded by the death of Chip Margelli, K7JA, recently, that I thought he was such a wonderful ambassador for ham radio. And this guy wouldn't even let his own cancer. I mean, this guy had cancer that he was privately battling. He did not let that get in the way of him being an example for amateur radio. And he's not having a memorial service because it's not about him. Essentially, what he would want you to do is get on the air and rock field day. He wants you to get on and have fun in field day. So I'll tell you, we need less like the people who jam nets, and we need more people like Chip. And this goes for on-air and off-air activities. If you are in a position of leadership in the amateur radio community, you know, you need to set a good example. You need to be a good egg. You need to treat your fellow hams with respect, frankly. And, you know my experiences. I've had some people not do that to me. And in other places, I've had people who want to work with me, and I want to work with them for the betterment of amateur radio. And I think that's the most important thing. What are you going to leave behind? Are you going to leave behind where you are the person who the FCC had to come down and essentially police you in a self-policing service? Or are you going to leave behind somebody who everybody said was such a wonderful example, such a wonderful ambassador to our hobby? You know, so it's a tale of two types of radio amateur. And I think that when I leave this earth, I want people to remember me the same way. I want people to remember me as a wonderful ambassador for amateur radio. I mean, you know, I try not to lessen people's pleasure on the air. I try to spread the little bit of knowledge I have on the air. And I spread it on this radio show, on my YouTube channel, on my, on my other things, the Substack, which is absolutely free right now. And I don't think I plan to charge for it anyway, because I love spreading the cheer and joy of amateur radio and the reward of seeing people like the newsletter and seeing them, you know, share the news around and enjoy amateur radio is enough for me. So, but, you know, enough about me. Like I said, it's about you. It's about you, the radio amateur. But in the end, people will see it as you, the personality, you know, and yeah. And, you know, there's also something else on my mind. I mean, there's been a lot of radio amateurs who have been leaving us and not under pleasant circumstances, meaning that they pass away and quite suddenly. And that kind of brings me to pause, you know, are we doing enough to bring the next generation into this hobby? You know, are we doing enough? I think we need to do more. As such, you know, you need to probably reach out to your schools. You need to reach out to not even the young kids. You need to reach out to people in their 30s, their 20s, you know, people in college and university. I think that's a perfect place to introduce people to ham radio. So what are you doing? Think about it for a minute. What are you doing? All right, let's come back and we'll talk about what you're doing.
So, you know, one of the great things about having HF radio is the ability to work DX, but you need to know where you can find this DX, and you can actually find all the latest news, tips, tricks, scuttlebutt, and on-the-scene reports at dx-world.net. That's dx-world.net. My friend Cole and his fabulous crew of correspondents bring you all the latest DX news from around the world right into your ham shack. Okay, so check out dx-world.net, and they also supply the news here on Rhea's Ham Shack. So if you want to get the source of the news, you go to dx-world.net. That's dx-world.net.
Okay, let's talk about the news. And this week, well, the first item of news that I mentioned, Chip Margelli, K7JA, and he passed away on the 25th of May. 2023. So Chip was well known and loved in the community. Chip loved ham radio, but he particularly loved contesting Field Day and Morse code. So in 2005, Chip appeared on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. And the appearance featured a competition between text messaging and Morse code to see which one could deliver a message faster. Surprisingly or not surprisingly, Morse code won. And there's a video. You can actually see the video on my Substack, n2rj.substack.com. Chip was, he was well known in the community. He worked at a number of ham radio companies in his career, including Yaesu, Heil, Force 12. And the last place I remember him working was Ham Radio Outlet. So I knew Chip. You know, we talked about a number of different things in radio, the supply chain issues and all the other stuff, why people are buying up ham equipment. And he had a lot of valuable industry insight. I was really amazed at the kind of knowledge, you know, that he had in the brain trust. He knew Japanese and he had a call sign K7JA. He was an Amateur Radio Hall of Fame. And, you know, he was just super. If you want to remember him, send your QSL card. You can send it to Chip Margelli, K7JA, at 6652. And I'll spell it out. C-E-R-U-L-E-A-N Avenue, Garden Grove, California, 92845, USA. So again, his address is 6652 Cerulean Avenue. That's C-E-R-U-L-E-A-N Avenue, Garden Grove, California, 92845. Yeah, send him your card, you know. His wife will get them and, you know, they'll put his memory up there so people can see it. So, yeah, like I said, you know, Chip is one of those who you want to be like, you know. You want to be like Chip. You don't want to be a lid. Well, next, let's talk about the lid. So the FCC has sent a notice of apparent liability for forfeiture for $24,000 against Philip J. Baudet for Baudet, or however you pronounce his name, for apparently willingly and repeatedly interfering with the radio communications of the Western Amateur Radio Friendship Association while it was attempting to hold a regularly scheduled net and for failing to provide station identification. And the FCC essentially said that how the commission has received numerous complaints alleging that Baudet caused intentional interference to other amateur radio operators using frequency 3.908 megahertz and failed to transmit his assigned call sign in apparent violations of Section 333 of the Act and Sections 97.101D and 97.119A of the Commission's rules. On November 2022, in response to continued complaints, an agent from the San Francisco field office of the FCC's Enforcement Bureau drove to Burney, California to investigate the complaints. The agent monitored frequency 3.908 megahertz and used direction finding techniques to identify the source of the transmissions as Baudet's amateur radio station's N6PJB, which he was operating at his residence in Burney, California. The agent monitored the transmissions and for 2 hours and heard him playing recordings that caused interference to the ongoing net while failing to provide his call sign. So the agent drove on November 29th to continue the investigations and monitored and used direction finding techniques. And he heard the music again December 1. an agent again returned and then again found music playing. And so they found that he willfully and repeatedly violated Section 333. And he apparently willfully and repeatedly violated Section 333 and 97.101 and 97.119. So he really got into it and really, he failed to transmit his call sign. I mean, obviously, when you're calling interference, you probably won't want to transmit your call sign. The FCC gave him a fine of $23,727 for each violation. So they fined a proposed a base forfeiture of $7,000 and for causing interference, and a base forfeiture of $1,000 for failing to provide identification. So they gave him 7 3s 21 plus 1,000 times 3 3,000, so that's $24,000. So in applying the applicable statutory factors, they considered whether there's any basement for downward adjustment. They didn't find any, and they said that future violations could result in significantly higher forfeitures or revocation of his amateur license. Okay. And so they gave him a fine in summary, and he has to now either appeal it or he has to pay up. There were other radio amateurs who willfully did some of the same things. One guy, he kind of, he interfered with the same net. They fined him a lot of money, and then he just basically told them pound sand. And then what happened is when his license was up for renewal, they basically red-lighted him and told him that his license is revoked because he owes them money. This one could get to that stage. It could be that, or he could just decide to get scared and pay up. Who knows? But it's not a nice thing. You know, what kind of legacy you want to leave? Do you want to leave the legacy of the person who did good in the world, or you want to be the jammer? Your choice, not mine. Yours. Now, in other news, we covered the Hamvention broadcast by WRMI Legends. As you know, listeners to this radio station enjoy the quality program from WRMI Legends. They have the oldies format. They have all the DJs. So Ted Randall and Holly and the rest of the family set up the Hamvention Live from Dayton Hamvention, and it was pretty nice. They had guests on to broadcast. And it's been a long-standing tradition, actually, and invites some of the attendees to come on and broadcast with Ted. It was carried on a special frequency on WRMI during the day. Of course, you know Jeff Lawrence did the whole live remote broadcast. I contributed something for that, and it was very nice to be part of that. So Ford, next story up is Ford bringing back AM radio in cars. So the Ford Motor Company has reversed its decision to remove AM radio and will enable AM radio via software update. Jim Farley said that Ford will include AM radio in every 2024 Ford vehicle. It's kind of amazing because not only are they bringing it back, but they're also bringing it back via software update. So this makes me wonder, they had this capability all along. Why did they take it out? it boggles the mind. But anyway, so they said they're going to bring it back in software update. That's good news. And my congressman, Josh Gottheimer, who has been really, really adamant on this, he even held a press event in front of a Tesla service center, delivery center. So it's been kind of interesting. You know, Michelle Bradley was telling me how the New Jersey State Broadcasters Association has been very aggressive behind this, which is probably why Gottheimer is doing it. AM radio, of course, seems to be the band that just doesn't die. And even though we're losing roughly one AM license a week, it's kind of been, you know, it's still there. So, in another bit of news about interference, so the FCC has issued a citation to Luis Martinez, an individual who was apparently cited for interfering with T-Mobile wireless on 2500 megahertz. The interference came from security cameras that were tuned to frequencies not authorized for unlicensed use and which were in fact in use by wireless carrier T-Mobile. In May 2022, after a complaint by T-Mobile, the FCC sent field agents from the Columbia, Maryland field office to Martinez's home and warned him about the interference. The agents also provided instructions on how to change the frequencies to alleviate the interference. Martinez claimed to have followed T-Mobile's instructions and changed the remaining two camera settings in an attempt to end the interference. However, the interference persisted, and subsequent tests by the field agents determined that the cameras were in fact still causing interference. So they gave him a citation. They didn't actually fine him, but they threatened fines. And they said, fix it or else. We'll see how that goes. Shifting gears a little bit to the FCC, still on the FCC, Joe Biden, the president, has nominated telecommunications attorney Ana Gomez to serve as the FCC commissioner. So Gomez has served at the FCC for over 12 years and as a deputy administrator at the NTIA, that's the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. And she is currently senior advisor at the Bureau of Cyberspace and Digital Policy at the U.S. State Department. The previous nominee, Gigi Sohn, withdrew her nomination after opposition from Senate Republicans and Senator Joe Manchin. So Senator Joe Manchin, once he gave his thumbs down, she withdrew the nomination within hours, I was told. What impact this will have for amateur radio is yet unclear. However, fresh faces at the FCC have the potential to have a fresh look at pending amateur radio matters. ARRL's Legislative Advocacy Committee also currently has a bill pending before Congress to direct the FCC to unrestrict the symbol rate for amateur radio data transmissions on HF, which has been a key policy goal of the ARRL. So essentially, those of you who don't know, that if you want to send data on HF radio, you're limited to 300 baud. And 300 baud, to tell you how slow that is the data rate that we used when we had these suction cup modems for computers. Yeah, like, you know, you take the telephone off the hook and you put it on the suction cup and use that for a modem. Yeah, that was the data rate back then. So today we're stuck with that. And, you know, the ARRL for a long time has been trying to change that, admittedly because they want higher data rates for Winlink. But, you know, generally we should seek to modernize that. I don't know why we don't. But the FCC has kind of been stalling on that. AMSAT, keeping amateur radio in space. They have been nominating, they're soliciting nominations for the 2023 AMSAT Board of Directors election. The election will be held in the third quarter of 2023. So they had more information in their weekly bulletin. Good luck to them. Down under in Australia, I wonder if I have any listeners in Australia. The Australian government is going to take back amateur licensing. So I didn't know this, actually. I didn't know that the Australian Maritime College administered amateur radio licensing on behalf of the government, and they will be withdrawing the service. So they are going to be withdrawn from providing services for amateur licensing. The functions will be returned to the Australian Communications and Media Authority, ACMA, and the arrangement with AMC was problematic, according to some reports, because there was slow processing time and fee increases. Previously, AMC had administered the exams and recommended call signs. Under the new scheme, examiners will be accredited directly by the ACMA, and the ACMA will directly issue call signs. So those are some news items from the Substack. And, you know, if you want to see more news, you can go to n2rj.substack.com, where you can get the news directly here on Ria's Ham Shack. All right, let's take a break and come right back with some Q&A.
All the ways to listen to Ria's Ham Shack, let me count the ways. The first and the best way is, of course, on WRMI Legends 5050 on your shortwave dial and other frequencies as appropriate. You can also listen on the podcast wherever you get your favorite podcasts. You can listen on WRMILegends.com, where we have it on the live stream. You can catch it on the Ria Ham Shack YouTube channel. Just look for youtube.com/@n2rj. I publish a show, and it's always a few days after it airs on WRMI Legends. And if you want to get the show first, you go on WRMI Legends 5050 Shortwave or on WRMILegends.com. Of course, you can also go on WRMILegends.com to find out ways to support the show and support the station and to keep the tubes glowing and keep the fabulous shortwave programming coming. Now back to Ria's Ham Shack.
Okay, let's talk Q&A. And let's actually talk about questions. So you know that the new general class question pools come into effect this year. And actually, the new technician test came into effect last year. And I wrote a book for the new technician pool. The book that people wanted to ban, right? And you know who I mean by people. But the question is that this person is currently studying for a technician test, and there's a new edition of the question pool book, but the material in the older editions is still valid, besides the exact wording in the question pool. So this person is trying to do more than just memorize the questions and really understand the material. So I'll tell you this, the material is timeless. Pretty much most of what is on the exam is really not really new. I mean, how much is going to change in terms of radio physics over time? Absolutely nothing, unless we discover something brand new and groundbreaking. Tad Rappaport, are you listening? Are you going to discover something new and groundbreaking? I know, I had to kind of make that joke, but he really did discover some things new and groundbreaking because he was the man who basically proved that you could use millimeter waves for 5G. And it's because of him that we now have 5G on millimeter waves. So Ted did some serious work. And Ted, he founded a wireless research institute at my alma mater, New York University Tandon School of Engineering. And you can check them out at wireless.engineering.nyu.edu. So anyway, getting back to the question. So the answer is not much has changed. Not a lot has changed. Yes, there are some changes. There are a few things that have changed. But, you know, most of the material is the same. Frankly, if you study from the older book, really does not change much. And if you study from the older book and you take new tests, well, you're not really going to have much of a problem, really. So don't worry too much about it. So the next question is from Audrey, and she asks, does wildfire smoke have any effect on HF propagation? So before I go into the in-depth explanation, the answer is generally no. Not for HF, not for ionospheric propagation, HF. There are a few unrelated things to propagation that wildfires could typically do. The first of which, of course, is that wildfires cause all sorts of destruction And if they're like, for example, if they're destroying homes and power lines and such like that, you're probably going to have interference from, you know, electrical infrastructure being damaged and stuff like that. But that's not really directly by the fires. On VHF and UHF, there is a little bit of a thing that could happen. One of them is that, yes, the fires could carry moisture. But there's actually a study in Australia that showed that they actually are multiple things that can cause fires, that fires can do with radio propagation. And these are primarily on the VHF and above bands. And these are typically, their studies were on 50 megahertz and above. So from this study, they actually did several tests and they found that signal strength on like 900 megahertz kind of decreased with the fires in full effect. And they actually proposed a number of different causes. They had, I'm trying to find some of it here. They said basically that the plasma has a very it has somewhat of an effect on these on the radio waves. So I'll read from here. They said plasma in fire environments. A plasma is a state of matter that contains charged particles that freely move. When an electromagnetic wave impinges on a plasma, energy is imparted to the charged particles, tracking the oscillation of the electric and magnetic fields. The higher the density of free charged particles, the more energy that is coupled into the plasma and particle motion. The flame region of a fire consists of free electrons and charged particles, which are generated by the combustion process. The positive ions have a mass which is generally 2,000 times greater than an electron, and because of this, the electrons are dominant in interactions with electromagnetic radiation. The formation of a combustion-induced plasma will be discussed in a section on combustion. Okay, so they talk about that. They say, whilst the plasma particle is moving with the field, if a collision occurs, momentum is lost, and electromagnetic, and this is important, electromagnetic energy is transferred and dissipated. This results in attenuation of the electromagnetic wave. Attenuation and dispersion of microwaves for ionized gases has been studied by Marginot, Schneider, and Hoffman, applied Marginot's theory to ionized gases and flames. Using an experimental technique involving the attenuation of microwaves, Sugden et al. Studied the electron concentration of alkaline salts in coal air flames and hydrogen air flames. The number of collision of electrons with neutral particles per second is referred to as a collision frequency. When an electron is met by an oscillating electric field, its mean displacement is mathematically expressed by an equation. So bottom line, they say, as can seen from equation, the collision frequency has the effect of dampening the electron oscillation. And so essentially, they found that the theory is that they're going to have some attenuation with the fire. And propagation of radio waves through a fire inherently includes propagation through a background medium. And this is, of course, in forest environments. In a bushfire, this background medium encompasses some form of vegetation. So it's important to consider the propagation of radio waves through a forested environment. And they do a lot of discussion about the forest and also how the effects of water distribution and movement in the plant and so on. So in a nutshell, yeah, there is some effect, but it's not going to affect your ionospheric propagation, you know, in a way that's really noticeable, because HF propagation isn't really that sensitive to local conditions. Like HF frequencies are so low, the radio waves bend around a lot of things. I mean, my friend Peter W2IRT, he lives behind a big hill. blocking him to Europe, and he still makes a lot of radio contacts. So, you know, I mean, this just goes to show that making contacts is not really a measure of measuring how good your antenna is, but had that been VHF, you might have had a problem. I live behind some hills, you know, toward New York for VHF, and I have to rely on something called edge diffraction, where the waves actually bend over the top of the hill, and then they bend downwards into the valley, and then you know, some of them scatter and come up by me up the other hill. So that's how it goes. Yeah, so I think you're going to have to blame somebody else. I mean, propagation of the bands have been really not that good lately. So I think that is more likely to be a problem. Next question is, how does the FCC enforce ham radio? Well, the FCC kind of does enforce ham radio, but it's based on complaints. As we've seen from the earlier news article, what happens is that people have to complain to the FCC, and usually the complaints these days can be direct to the FCC, but often they're through the ARRL Volunteer Monitoring Program. And yes, I know there are people who say how the ARRL has no enforcement powers, yada, yada, yada. Well, the fact is the ARRL doesn't have any enforcement powers, shocker there. But what they do have is a memorandum of understanding with the FCC. And what this allows them to do is to communicate directly with the FCC and report cases, gather evidence, and submit them to the FCC. And then the FCC follows up with its own enforcement. But, you know, for minor violations, the FCC is not really going to be, you know, coming down on you. I mean, you really have to be King Lid or Queen Lid, but it's mostly King Lid, for the FCC to come down and issue you a fine. I mean, you know, like we heard about that jammer. He was allegedly, I have to say allegedly, jamming for several times before the FCC even gave him the time of day. They found that he repeatedly did it. And once they did that, they proposed a fine to him. So that's how it works. I mean, you know, they're not going to just come in and just raid you like that. So that's how FCC enforcement works. You can see even with commercial entities that the FCC, what the FCC is going to do is that they rely upon complaints. Like when this guy with his camera was allegedly interfering with T-Mobile, T-Mobile engineers had to complain to the FCC, and then the FCC came and then did their investigation, and then they found out that, yes, he was interfering. So, yeah. So all of that stuff, you know. And, you know, you really, like I said, you really have to be doing something terrible to catch their attention. I mean, generally, if you just go out of band and you operate on 7125 lower sideband, oh, my God, no. Well, no, the FCC is not going to come down on you, and they're not going to raid your house and take away all your radio equipment. But if you decide to, let's say, go on 14300 and jam the net all day, every day, well, yeah, they're going to come down on you, okay? So keep that in mind. All right, so the other question is about coaxial cables. And Cliff here asks, what's the real difference between RG8 and RG58 coax? And he also talks about RG8X. So let's talk about the difference between RG8 and RG58 right off the bat. RG8 is a thicker coax, and it has a different dielectrics and different characteristics in terms of its shielding and such like that. So RG8, RG58, yes, they are different. But the RG58 generally is a smaller coax designed more for mobile installations, and it's very smaller diameter, whereas RG8 is thicker and it's designed for fixed stations. However, both of these designs are kind of legacy designs, is that people don't really use them these days as much. And the RG8 kind of really, you know, RG8 of old is not really the same as RG8 today. I mean, most of what people use RG8 today is really RG213. And RG213 itself has become kind of like the de facto standard for affordable coax with decent loss figures, right? RG8X, on the other hand, it was an attempt to duplicate the performance of RG8 in a smaller cable. So it's better than RG58. On VHF and UHF, though, it's kind of still not good. For mobile installations and such now, you could run RG8X. And for HF, you know, I use 213. And for longer runs, of course, I use hardline, but that's expensive. So we'll see that. You know, it's very, it's a different set of things. I mean, you can actually, for HF really, especially in the low bands, it really doesn't matter. If you're running power, I would definitely run the RG213 at least. Like if you're running 1,000, 1,500 watts, you know, you want to run higher. A less lossy coax, one, because if you run a lossy coax with high power, I mean, all you're doing is heating up the worms in the earth, right? You're not doing anything else but that. All right. So this next question I was asked, to keep this anonymous, is that this person is new to 6 meters. Why is there so much FT8 activity and there's not a lot of CW and SSB? So FT8 has become popular on 6 meters in particular, because it actually does propagation. It takes advantage of weak propagation a lot better than CW and SSB. That's just one reason. So a signal you can barely hear on Morse code, CW, or voice, SSB, will be sort of almost perfectly readable on FT8. And the reason is that FT8 basically has a lot of error correction and also is very sensitive in terms of its bandwidth and such. So it's very, very good for weak signal work. And this has kind of been like a love-hate relationship. Some people love it because of that. And of course, some people hate it because it enables people to get, you know, DX awards without having to put in as much work as the people before them. Aw, poor babies. But anyway, it kind of, you know, it's a mixed bag. I like the challenge of CW and SSB, but you know what? I still work FT8 because, frankly, FT8 is here to stay and modes like it are here to stay. And I like that we push the limits of technology, of radio. I don't want us to be not pushing the limits. I think that that is definitely against the spirit of radio. If we're not pushing the limits of propagation, why do we even have amateur radio license if we're not doing that? Anyway, that is it. But the other reason is that with FT8, right, it is so easy for people to leave things automated 24/7, not only transmit, but receive, where you detect a band opening and you start transmitting, or the people who just basically start leave their station transmitting all the time. So there's always more chance for more signals, more people to work on there. Frankly, the most CW and SSB activity you're going to see on the bands is during the contest. If you want Morse code and you want single sideband activity, look for the contest, because that's where it's going to be. I remember last week where I said, contests are not a bad thing. Contests are training for emergency communications. And frankly, they're just training to be good radio operators. Forget emergency communications, right? Because that's just one of our basis and purpose. It's training you to be a good radio operator. So by all means, look for CW and SSB in the contest. That's where it'll be. So next question is, I need a radio recommendation. This is from Tom in the group Pam Radio. I need a radio recommendation from some of you who are talking on 2 meter single sideband. Well, there are a number of options. I will tell you that the ICOM radios, ICOM has a good number of options on 2 meters, by the way, especially that 705, the ICOM 705. It does up to 10 watts on this 705. You can also get some of the older radios like the ICOM 746, which is a nice radio. It has 160 through 2 meters, all modes, and 100 watts on 2 meters. The ICOM 9700 is good as well, too. That's a great radio on 2 meters. Of course, it's a great radio for working satellites and such, too. I know a lot of people use that for satellites. Really nice radio. Now, here is where it gets onto another things. I mean, the ICOM 7000 is another radio that does a lower power, well, like 45 watts, I believe. So a lot of radios nowadays are not doing the all mode thing. You kind of have to get into like a base radio for that. You know, you're really not finding it too much in mobile. I mean, I believe the ICOM 7100 does it. I'm not sure which others do it. Now, a lot of people actually are using, their HF radios and transverters where they take the HF output from their radios and then they put it into a transverter. And that essentially upconverts the signal from 10 meters to 2 meters. And that kind of gives you enough band coverage to operate on 2 meter and higher bands if you want to. So it's always a good thing. And it is, but, you know, Kenwood had the TS-2000. Well, of course, you know Kenwood's story. And you don't really have that many, unfortunately. The FT-991A, you know, you have like the FT-818. Yeah. There are people who still do 2 meters. There are people who do like POTA and SOTA on it. You know, Summits on the Air, Parks on the Air. And when the band opens up, frankly, it's a lot of fun. You know, you can get on the air. You can make some contacts. One of my radios, a Flex 6700, actually has 2 meters on it. The only problem is that it's not full power. So it doesn't have a power amplifier in 2 meters. What it has is a low-level output that you can feed into an external amplifier. And this company, Down East Microwave, actually makes a amplifier for it. Or you can use other amplifiers. They're actually full legal limit amplifiers from, I believe, Beko is one who makes one that you can take that low-level signal and get up to 1,500 watts legal limit. So, or you could probably get like 1 kilowatt or something close to legal limit power using that. So that's another thing. But as I mentioned previously, Flex is discontinuing the 6700. So that's not going to be an option anymore unless you get a used one. But there are always options. And hopefully, you know, even with the ICOM 705, you can drive a low drive amplifier and you can get, you know, a higher power out. So, hey, you know, there are always options available. So here's another question by Bart here in the group Ham Radio. How are you all bonding your shack ground rod to your main service ground? when they're located at opposite ends of your home? Well, there's really only one good way to do it. And unfortunately, it's not going to be a cheap one. What you can do is you have to put ground rods about 16 feet apart all the way along to your service ground. Now, you will have to, with those grounds, what you will have to do is you will have to either tie those together with these clamps, and you have to inspect those clamps regularly, or you could exothermically weld them. The best solution, of course, is to simply run the grounds, you know, run your station ground as close to your service ground as possible, and then you bond them together there too. You know, there's no easy way. I mean, grounding is kind of a dark art, but it's not really. I mean, the really important thing about grounding and bonding is that you want grounding and bonding. You want your connection to be as close as, you know, as low impedance as possible. Close to 0 ohms impedance as possible. The reason is that if you have like a lightning event nearby, you want everything to basically remain at the same potential. If they're not at the same potential, you'll find that the lightning or event is going to find some path through your equipment rather than the lowest impedance path. So just bear that in mind. Always got to bear that in mind. So this question is about everybody's favorite radio, Baofeng. So Butch asks, I see on eBay the UV9R has 18 watts output. Is that real for an HT? And would one really want that much RF next to their head? So I'll answer the second question first. The answer is no. You don't want that much RF next to your head. And you need to watch my RF safety video if you think that's a good idea. So go to youtube.com/@n2rj and watch the video. The first question is, it's complicated. I'm guessing no, it doesn't really have 18 watts output. But I've seen a few Chinese handhelds that have really high power. The problem is some of them will have really high harmonics too. So yeah, you know, you might have high power, but you know, do you have it on one frequency or all the frequencies? But no, I don't believe that fantastic claim, to be honest. I think they're closer to 4 watts output. I think that's probably the most you're going to get out of them. I don't think you're going to get anything more than that. So really, it's not, you know, the UV9R, people have tested it and it's 4 watts. And you'll find that a lot of these radios, they're kind of just, you know, they're kind of stretching the truth. Now, some people have also said that the Baofeng UV9R has reported 8 watts. But, you know, when people measure them, it's actually closer to 4 watts. So I really don't think that, you know, that you need to worry too much about that. Anyway, most handhelds, like I said, are 5 watts for a reason. And the reason is that anything beyond that is kind of unsafe and exceeds FCC regulations. All right, here's another question. I want to make a multiband fan dipole to put in my attic. What's the smallest gauge wire that I should use? And I have a lot of old Cat 5 cable. Okay. Also, my attic's only 48 feet long. Can I bend the ends to make it fit? If you're using 100 watts, yeah, you could use the strands of Cat 5. But, you know, I don't know if I'm using higher power. First of all, if I'm using higher power, I'm not using an attic dipole, right? Because I would violate FCC safety rules. But, no. But the other thing is, can you bend the ends? Absolutely. There are people who bend the ends. And nobody said a dipole had to be straight. So what a lot of people do is they actually bend the ends And, you know, they bend it down as long as it doesn't loop back into the dipole, because then that kind of makes it shorter. But if you bend it down, you know, let it droop or something, yeah, you're not really going to have any problems. It just, you know, adds to the capacitance of the antenna. You do lose some gain. So, you know, it's going to be fine. So not really a problem. I mean, it's obviously not going to be good as a full-size dipole, but it's not going to be a problem. All right. So I got a question here. I want to buy an amplifier, but I notice that the amplifier uses what are called TV sweep tubes. Is this good to buy? And if not, why not? Well, back in the day, it was a good plan. So TV sweep tubes essentially are amplifier tubes for the sweep circuit inside of the old TV sets. And back in the days of tube TVs, these were plentiful. You could actually buy them at the drugstores. Well, as tube TVs gave way for solid state, these became very scarce to the point of being unobtainium. And you will not be able to buy them pretty much anywhere new at all. The new old stock is probably limited. And a lot of, I don't even think the Chinese tube factories make them. And if you do find them, they're very expensive. So I would kind of stay away from that, because you don't want something to that you can't get tubes for, because if the tubes fail, and they do, tubes have a limited life, by the way. You don't want to be up that creek without a paddle. Tubes in general, though, for amplifiers are not bad. I mean, they still make a lot of tubes for amplifiers. Like, I know the 811 and 572Bs are still made in the Chinese factories, and MFJ kind of sells them, and others sell them. You find plenty on eBay. So, you know, you could buy some of those Chinese tubes and they'll work just fine. You could still find a lot of these ceramic tubes for the, I guess, that were made by the Russians, the Soviets, or whoever. You still get a lot of those. You could still get some from medical pulls from medical equipment, because, yeah, they used, you know, amplifier tubes. So, yeah, so there's still a lot of tubes available. But as far as the sweep tubes, no, I would stay away from them. And it's unfortunate because, you know, they were cheaper back in the day, okay? And they ran these tubes essentially to their limit. So it really, it was an innovative solution at the time, but really did not carry forward to today. So the final question is, if you are in a digital station, do you announce your call sign the same way as an analog, or is there a more appropriate way? So under U.S. regulations, well, it depends. So if your mode sends it in Morse code, either way, you're fine. If you say it on phone, you're fine. If you are sending a data emission, right? So in terms of, if you're using something like D-Star, or I believe Yaesu System Fusion, and you're sending your call sign in a data stream along with the voice transmission, sure, the call sign in the data stream will suffice. If you're using something like DMR, and DMR does not have an amateur call sign in its data stream, then you must say your call sign on voice. This does not even, you know, does not matter if you're using like a lookup table or something to a call sign database. Nope, you have to say it on DMR. All right, that'll do it for this week. I am Rhea, call sign N2RJ, and you've been listening to Rhea's Hamjack. Would like to thank everyone who makes the show possible. You, the listeners, also Ted Randall, Holly, and the rest of WRMI Legends crew. Jeff Lawrence, who does our fabulous voiceovers. And of course, Jeff White and the crew at WRMI in Okeechobee, Florida, for airing keeping the transmitters running and everything. All right, until next time, my friend, peace and 73. And I'll see you at the next one, okay? Have a great week. I am N2RJ. Bye.